Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program once again David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business, and on Fridays, once a month, he stops by here and we talk about personal finance. And the way we do this is he begins with making a few comments sometimes about a particular investment topic, and this time around he says he just wants to say some things about the economy or about economics. And then if people have questions about that or about, the practical implications of where we are right at the moment and what you might want to think about in terms of your investment strategies, given where we are right at the moment, all those kind of questions are certainly welcome. Well, with that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, it's certainly an economic storm out there with a continuing barrage of negative economic data, a falling stock market. However, I think it's quite instructive to step back for just a moment and review, really, how did we get here? And secondly, perhaps as investors, what should we be doing? And of course, third, this morning, we will review our couch potato equity portfolio. Well, let's tackle the first question. How in the world did we get here? And in fact, the root of our present economic difficulties really can be traced back to the early to mid-80s. In fact, during the past 25 to 30 years, we really have borrowed ourselves to the brink of this economic crisis, thanks in large measure to our own government policy of cheap money, a new generation of kids and grandkids, call them the now generation, of unsustainable consumption. And that unsustainable consumption was really based on very inexpensive imported goods on the backs of very cheap foreign labor. For example, in 1980, take our U.S. national debt. It was about $900 billion, or about a third of our GDP. As of January 31st of this year, prior to the stimulus, national debt exceeded $10.6 trillion, or 75% of GDP. By the end, I think it's safe to say, of President Obama's first term, national debt is probably going to be just about what our GDP is. It's going to be about 100% of our GDP. Interest expense annually today on our national debt is now running about $450 billion. Now, that's a tough number to get our hands around, but let me compare it this way. If we look at all of the people in our country who are receiving Social Security benefits, that's about $600 billion. We aren't even spending $450 billion on national defense on an annualized basis, and that's what the interest is now running on our deficit. Since 1980, our gross domestic product has dramatically jumped. It's jumped five times, or 500%. But at the same time, our national debt has increased 10 times, or approximately 1,000%, or twice as fast. Let's talk about consumers for just a minute. Back in 1980, consumer debt, which really meant how much we had on credit cards and how much we owed on our automobiles, was about $350 billion. Today, it's close to $2.7 trillion. In other words, consumers have increased their credit card debt and their automobile debt by about seven times, 700% in 28 years. Experian, one of the major credit reporting companies, tells us that the average American with a credit card today is carrying a balance of at least $8,000 to $9,000. And let's add in some automobile debt. That takes us up to $16,000 for those of us that carry a credit card. And that doesn't include our mortgage debt. That's a pretty awesome number. And if we look at really all of the debt, U.S. government debt, all of the state debt, all of our personal debt, and vast, vast, vast amounts of corporate debt, mortgage debt, etc., you can hardly believe this number. It's a $50 trillion number. It's actually almost five times our gross domestic product. In fact, it's no secret, we are the most indebted people in the history of the globe, and unfortunately, we don't have the savings or the capital to just quickly climb out of the quagmire. In 1980, for example, Americans saved 12% of their paycheck. Now, that's not counting what they put into their mortgage. It's not counting what went into a profit sharing or pension plan. That was 12 cents of every take-home dollar out of their paycheck. Today, Americans save about 1%. And it was actually a negative number until very, very recently. But here's the major problem. We can deal with debt so long as our incomes are expanding. But in 1980, median household income was about $40,000 per family. And today, it's about $50,000 per family. So here's the bottom line. Over the last 25 to 30 years, income adjusted for inflation for a family has gone up about 20%. But at the same time, household debt has gone up 700%, 35 times more than median income. Obviously, these numbers are not sustainable. So whether it's housing debt, whether it's our foreclosure situation, whether it's our automobile debt, our credit card debt, our corporate debt, our U.S. debt, the bottom line is that we have built ourselves quite a little mountain of debt. And the point is, will it eventually be solved? Yes, this debt will be unwound, but it's going to take some time. There is not a quick fix. A $787 billion stimulus program might be a step. We'll have to wait and see, but it certainly it is not a quick fix. So consumers are now realizing for the first time, all of us are realizing that we really need to pay down debt. And for the first time in our history, at least in the last 25 to 30 years, we are starting to do that as opposed to spending. Here's the problem. 70% of our economy is based on spending, consumer spending. The other 30% is made up of government spending, trade balance, and business investment. Consumer spending is going down. Trade balance is a negative number. Business investment is a negative number, as we know, because of all of the unemployment and all of the layoffs. So to make GDP go positive, to increase the expansion of our economy, that only leaves the government sector. And that's why we're seeing so many dollars being spent by the government. Okay? So that's where we're at. Now, we could talk about all the grim statistics. There's no reason to state them over and over and over again. It just creates a more negative mentality. The real issue is, what are we going to do about it as investors? What can we do in today's economy as investors? Because that seems to be an important question. First, it seems to me that if you are retired or you are contemplating retirement, you need to have some liquid fixed income assets, because it's a tragedy if you have to go in and sell your stocks at the current time after they have dropped in value 40, 50, 60% or more. And it seems to me that we need to have a cash reserve. I used to believe 6 to 12 months. I've changed my thinking. We now need a cash reserve of perhaps as much as 36 to 48 months of our expenses, not of our income, but of our expenses. So we should be building that prior to moving into retirement, because otherwise we can have this period of time where we'd be forced to sell our stocks at very depressed prices. Here's the good news. The good news is that clearly we are closer to a bottom than a top in the stock market. Now, it's been ugly this year. The S&P 500, through yesterday's close, for example, is down well over 12%, frankly, almost closer to 13%. And our couch potato portfolio, as I'm going to tell you in just a moment, has fared even worse. It's down almost 16%. But as a student of stock markets, going back well into the 1920s, when stocks dropped 90% approximately in one day, I feel very, very strongly, in my professional opinion, that we are closer to a bottom than we're at a top. And that means that stocks are going to have a turnaround. When? We're not sure. Is it going to be next week, next month? No one has that crystal ball. But I think that this does represent an historic buying opportunity. And for those who have the courage, who have the cash, who can step in front of the train, they are going to be rewarded. Now, when I talk about buying stocks, I'm talking about dollar cost averaging into positions. If you're already in a profit-sharing plan, a 401k plan, some kind of self-directed plan, maybe an IRA program, you are having the opportunity with your money to dollar cost average, which means taking the same amount of money every month and committing it to financial securities. I believe that if you are a 401k investor, for example, and even if you're in your 50s, today at least 50% of all of your 401k contributions, all of your new money, should be invested in a diversified portfolio of stocks. And I believe that if you are a young person in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, that's pretty young because you've got a very long-term time horizon, that I believe closer to 100% of new money should be invested in the stock market. Now, if you are contemplating purchasing a home, it seems to me that the market differs very, very much across geographical areas. For example, in our local community of Champaign-Urbana, I think prices are pretty close to where they are going to level out at the current time. In other markets, however, I think very, very large metropolitan markets, including Chicago, I think prices are going to still trend a bit lower, and I'll tell you why. First of all, we have not abated foreclosures. Even with the $75 billion stimulus program announced yesterday to stem and to subsidize people who are going into foreclosure, we have lots of foreclosures every day. Here's an interesting statistic. One house is going into foreclosure every 11 seconds in the United States. It's hard to believe. One every 11 seconds. Approximately 3.5 million are going to go into foreclosure just this year, if we can believe the estimates. Also, unemployment, as we all know, we read the statistics every day, it's continuing to get worse. Housing prices cannot stabilize in major metropolitan markets until foreclosures reach an equilibrium and unemployment stops dropping, because people who are unemployed can't make mortgages and they can't buy new properties. So we have to turn that around. So in major metropolitan areas, until we see that hitting equilibrium, if I was an investor and considering purchasing in a major metropolitan area, I think I would wait. I would look to see when those sort of statistics reach some kind of bottom, some kind of equilibrium. But in other markets, Champaign-Urbana markets, smaller markets, number one, we didn't have that dramatic inflationary impact, that logarithmic increase in real estate values that we saw in other areas. So we haven't dropped precipitously in Champaign-Urbana. And in fact, in some areas, we've actually seen a slight rise in real estate prices. At the same time, mortgage rates are very, very impressive. In other words, they're great. You can go out and you can be in the fives. Occasionally, they dip down into the fours, 30-year mortgages. So money is cheap right now in terms of being able to procure mortgage money. So if you have a credit score of 740 or better, and you are employed, and you are looking for a home, a condominium, in a smaller market, it's a good time, in my view. It may go down a little bit, but you have to be a long-term investor. Just like in the stock market, as we have seen, you have to make a lifelong commitment, a 30 to 35-year commitment in the stock market. So could things get worse? Yes, they could get worse in the short run. Will things ultimately turn around and get better? Of course. Of course they will. And stocks, in my view, are real close to being on sale. They're cheap. Housing prices are going to eventually reach an equilibrium, and there are going to be amazing investment opportunities for young people. I should mention, part of the stimulus package, there's an $8,000 tax credit for first-time home buyers. If you buy a house between January 1 of 2009, December 31 of 2009, and you hold that house for 3 years, you're going to get an $8,000 boost. There's going to be $8,000 of either a rebate from taxes, or you're going to receive $8,000 toward the payment of that house. Okay, that's a pretty good incentive to purchase a house. So if you're purchasing a $100,000 property, $8,000, that's 8%. you could essentially see that house go down 8% and you would still be break even because someone is providing you $8,000 to purchase that house. So there are some positives out there. And the most important thing is not to get terribly negative because that just creates a worse and worse spiral. Part of this, of course, is psychological. A great deal of it is economic. But in my professional view, we are closer to a bottom than a top. And I think looking back, maybe 36, 48, 54 months out, we'll see enormous opportunities that existed in February of 2009. So there you have it, David, sort of an economic analysis. I'd be happy to focus, however, on financial planning questions because I don't consider myself an economic expert. I'm just gleaning statistics and sort of weaving a mosaic as I see it.
All right. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at University of Illinois. Once a month on Friday, he's here and we talk about personal finance. So if you have a question, I know he will do his best to help you out. Certainly he'll give you his advice. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let us talk with some callers here. We have a caller to start us out in St. Joe, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Excuse me. Good morning.
Yes.
Dr. Sinnoh, what would you advise a retired client if asked how they could best use their savings generated throughout the year? And you're given several options. One, either the early payoff of an adjustable rate loan, personally at 4.9%, or purchase in equal amounts Vanguard's total stock market index and or the international stock index, why they're on sale, and would you suggest other better options of how to use savings generated throughout the year?
Well, first of all, if you itemize on your tax return.
No, I don't.
Okay. Then you are truly paying a 4.9%. And on that 4.9%, not only are you paying the interest, but you're also paying principal. So for every dollar that you pay down on that mortgage, your cash flow is actually greater than 4.9%. On the other hand, so that would suggest maybe you should pay it down if you're not itemizing because obviously you're paying yourself the 4.9%. And it's very, very difficult to earn 4.9% cleanly out there in today's market.
Well, I guess I should clarify that. On our taxes, it's a standard deduction, but it's farmland. It's deducted from the 40.
Okay. So you do have it. So you have a tax deduction.
Yes.
So my view is I would let that ride. Is it an adjustable rate?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, I think those rates are going to stay pretty flat for a period of time. It's in everyone's interest to see those low interest rates. And so I think that at the moment, that's a very handsome rate, especially on farmland. So my proclivity would not be to pay it off. My proclivity then would be to dollar cost average your cash flow into the stock market. That's what I would do. Especially if you were underweighted in terms of your asset allocation, because most people who do farm, they have the lion's share of their assets in farmland, which is paid off. There's no question about it, especially family farmland. But at the same time, since you're not going to be selling that farmland and you want to build some additional liquidity and have some other type of asset completely different than farmland, a total stock market index makes perfect sense. So I would not have any problem with you averaging in, especially at these levels, into total stock market index, probably more into U.S. total stock market index, about 2/3 of my money, and maybe 1/3 of my money into international index.
Great. Okay. Super. Thanks a lot.
All my right, pleasure.
Thank you. Next caller is in Champaign, line two.
Hello.
Yes.
What would your opinion be of putting in place systems to prevent what's known as short selling, which, as I understand it, is artificially responsible for a lot of the volatility that we have in the market? You know, say there was a law that if you bought a particular stock, you know, 1,000 shares of XYZ widget, and say you had buyer's remorse within a certain period of time and decide to sell it, that'd be okay, you know, a short period of time, 2 weeks, a month, whatever. But then the rule is then you would be forbidden to purchase that stock again for a long period of time, say a year, 2 years, something like that. And otherwise, or any other kind of rule that one could think of that would force people basically to, if you're going to buy a stock, then buy it because you want it. You're going to hold it for a long time, and then you'll sell it after you've taken a tidy profit and so on and so forth, or for whatever reason you choose to sell it. But get this nonsense, I think, this noise in the system that's very corrosive of people that don't even own something, selling it and then buying it back at a later time when the price drops and pocketing a tidy sum in the meantime. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, you're talking about short sales, and for a period of time, if you'll recall, that the government did institute some very complicated rules about when you could short sell, that you couldn't short sell on certain types of what were called ticks, and that you had to wait for an uptick to sell as opposed to continuing to sell on down ticks. I have a bigger concern. My bigger concern is the notion that some governmental agency is going to regulate our financial markets. They are so regulated currently, and as you can see, day after day after day, we get closer, especially in the banking industry, to have just massive regulatory oversight, massive almost nationalizing the banks. This would be, it seems to me, just to be an awfully large step to nationalizing all of our financial markets. I'd be very concerned about it. I think in the short run, there can be some rules that can be instituted. I agree with you that there are some computer traders, although much less than there were even 6 months or a year ago. And it does have somewhat of an impact on the stock market. But in terms of legislating, people could no longer basically sell short, or if they bought, they would have to hold that position. I'm very concerned about legislating that kind of behavior in the financial markets. But your points are well taken. Certainly, we should take another look at short selling, computer short selling, and what could be done about it. One of the problems that we saw last time is that when we put these curbs on short sellers, that ultimately when we took those curbs off, that really increased the volatility in many of those securities. So I'm wondering if the cure is worse than the disease. I really don't have a solution, but I think you raise a great point. There should be lots more study and taking a much harder look as to what impact this short selling does have on the stock markets. I think it's probably less than what one really thinks, at least in this market time. But again, your points are well taken, and thank you for raising them.
All right. We're at our midpoint already. David Sinnoh is our guest, clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign, once a month. On a Friday, he's here. We talk about personal finance, money management. And if you have some specific questions about your own situation, we certainly are happy to take those. And I know Dave will do his best to help you out. You can use that as part of your research and your thinking about what you're doing with your money. We want you to think very carefully about what it is you're doing with your money. Make good decisions. And this is one piece that you can add to the puzzle as you try to make your investment strategies. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone, again, a next caller is in Champaign and line three. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor Sinnoh, always think it's interesting that people have lots of choices in what they do in their investing, and that stock people put people in stocks, and gold commodities people put them in commodities, and real estate people put them in real estate. I've kind of put 70% of my money in real estate, and mostly, you know, apartments and conservative things and in the local area and some in Florida. But I find that, you know, I'm weathering this period much better. My rents are still there. My properties are still appreciating. And I'm always, whenever I listen to financial planners and people, I'm always feel that they're pushing them. I don't see them diversifying with as much real estate as I think that I would counsel. And again, everybody has their bias towards what they can do, and not everybody's comfortable in real estate and managing it and things, but I know there's great funds out there that also emphasize real estate, and I wonder if you could give me some insight into, you know, the guy who puts 20% down and buys an apartment building, you know, his cash on cash returns versus somebody who's been in equities who is now at the same place he was at 2002, I think there's a great argument for having more in real estate in your portfolio. And then my second point is the fiduciary relationship with money managers, I think, has been a problem. It's, you know, it's a necessary evil. A guy earns his living by saying, I get paid by putting you in this fund. And I think a lot of the problems people are in is that fund managers and people have really been worried more about their commissions and how they earn a living than what they put their clients in. I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Okay, those are two great questions. Let's tackle the second one first regarding the fiduciary relationship with clients and earning money through commissions and fees. I couldn't agree with you more. That's one of the reasons that I promote something called the Couch Potato Portfolio at Vanguard, which basically is a series of index international U.S. mutual funds, which have an expense ratio of about 23 basis points. In other words, if you invest $1,000 in this type of portfolio, your actual expense ratio is around $2.50 per $1,000. People can't make a living on Wall Street. They can't support themselves in those fancy brownstones on that kind of expense ratio, and expenses make a tremendous difference. So as a result, that's why I'm counseling indexes, et cetera, that it's a very, very inexpensive way to have broad exposure to all of the various asset classes and stocks. Now, with respect to your issues and questions about real estate, your points are well taken. First of all, people have to have the money to invest in real estate beyond just their residential home. And if they're going to go out and buy income property, which I believe in, I'm an owner of income property myself, but it's not for everyone. Not everyone wants to be a landlord. And if you are a small-time investor, it's very, very difficult to hire professional management to run your real estate, because that's going to cost you somewhere between 7 and 12% of your gross rents. So let's start with the concept that a lot of people just don't want to be landlords and deal with that. I run into that all the time. But your second point is that there are a number of ways of investing in real estate through the securities markets. And one of those ways is included in our own couch potato portfolio, and that is called a REIT, a real estate investment trust, which is basically a publicly traded company that buys, sells, manages real estate, and it distributes dividends on the real estate at the same time. And REITs have a tax advantage if they essentially distribute 90% of their income back to the shareholders, then there is no double taxation, even though they are a corporation. Now, what I recommend if you want to participate in large categories of real estate, whether it's fixed income, whether it's apartment buildings, whether it's warehouses, whether it's shopping centers or hotels, is I feel more comfortable with a REIT index. And again, at Vanguard, they happen to have a REIT index. Now, if you go to the REIT index and look at it, it has just been tremendously hammered, even more so than almost any other asset class over the last 24 months. In fact, REITs as a category of investments are down some 30% year to date, because a lot of shopping centers are in trouble. The owners of those shopping centers, in other words, the REIT owners, are having trouble refinancing their debt. But I think over the long period of time, it's a very important asset class to have, and it behaves differently typically than all of the other asset classes. So I'm agreeing with you in principle that we should have a portion of our assets in real estate, but for many of us, beyond our residential home, one, it's not possible, and two, even if it is, we don't really want to become landlords. Hence, a REIT is certainly a viable alternative to just individually owning real estate. Now, as for yourself, if you have owned real estate in the Champaign-Urbana area, certainly the campus area, for a substantial period of time, there is no question that that has been a wonderful investment over many, many years. It takes diligence. It takes a lot of effort, and I commend you for doing it. In terms of an overall asset allocation, You have to look at the value of your residential real estate, and you look at the value of your real estate that is commercial real estate, and look as what you feel comfortable with as a percentage of your overall asset allocation. Is it 30%, 40%, 50%? Perhaps if you're in the farming business, it's 70, 80, 90%. That risk tolerance differs for each of us. But the bottom line is that real estate should be a piece of your asset allocation model. And I think that's the most important point that you're making. And number two, the other point that you made, which is so true, expenses make a difference. You want to be in investments that are very, very inexpensive.
Yeah, and just real quick to go back to the first question, I am assuming that if somebody was going to go out and look for a financial planner to work with, your recommendation would be use a fee-for-service planner, not someone who works on commission.
No question, David. We've sung that song, preached that to the choir for 15 to 20 years.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's continue. We'll talk next with someone in Palestine, Illinois, on our toll-free line. Line four,
Hello.
Right here. Hello.
Yeah, I'm just headed to Florida. I was going to look at some property, and but my wife does taxes, and she told me that she looked into the tax credit on first-time home buyers, and it was not a credit. It was a loan from the government.
Well, originally it was to be a loan.
In the fine print, it says in 2 to 3 years it's to be paid back over a period of time.
Well, no, not any longer. The congressional caucuses got together. The final bill changed it from a $7,500 payback loan over 10 years to an $8,000 actual tax credit. The regulations are not clear how that $8,000 is going to be delivered to an individual home buyer, but it is not to be paid back. That's my understanding of it. You do not have to pay it back. Now, if there's a CPA out there who studied it and said something different, please call in. But my understanding is it's now $8,000. You don't pay it back unless you sell your house within 36 months, and it is for a personal residence. It is not for buying the house and then for an apartment building or something like that.
I thought it was 2 days ago she's advising her clients not to do it. She got online and looked at that, but I don't know.
Okay, well, that's my understanding of it, is okay. Starting January 1 to December 31, you buy a personal residence, you're going to get $8,000 either through a tax rebate or some method through the government. The regulations have not come out as to how that money is specifically going to be transferred.
But it was that way, and it was changed.
Yes, yes, it is no longer a loan.
Okay, all right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's continue here, and our next caller will be somebody. on a cell phone, and that's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Over the last week or so, I've noticed in the market that the gold has been an alternative to the dollar as an investment and as an inflation hedge, because it seems like we're printing money, or so some people think. Why make gold better than any food or energy or any other type of commodity? I mean, it looks like if money's cheap, everything should be going up. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, this is a very interesting issue. As you can see, that gold has been in a trading range between $800 and $900, and now it is moving up toward $1,000. Here's what the people who are investing in gold believe. We're never going to be able to pay all of this debt back. So as a result, what we're going to do is we are really, really going to stoke up the printing presses. And if you own a treasury instrument, maybe a $5,000, $10,000, $100,000 treasury instrument, eventually, Uncle Sam is going to print some more money and is going to pay you back with just newly printed beautiful dollars or 20s, 50s, or $100 bills. The problem with doing that is that we're not creating more productivity. We're not producing more goods and services against those dollars in the economy. So when we print more money, pay it back, you tender your IOU back to the government, but we don't have more goods and services. All we've done is we put more cash into the system, and we're chasing the same amount of goods and services. Hence, price is likely to rise. Some people are referring to this as monetizing the debt. In other words, paying off our debt with very cheap dollars. And economically, at least in the past, when governments, societies have done this, basically it leads to very, very high levels of inflation. So, historically, one of the great hedges against high levels of inflation is gold. Hey, it seems to be a universal precious metal. It is not in great supply. So, as a result, it has become an important medium of exchange and a hedge against inflation. So, one strategy, if you believe that the government is going to print just tons of money to pay off debt, one strategy is to actually dollar cost average into gold. I'm talking about 1 ounce gold coins. Whether it's the Canadian maple leaf, whether it's the American eagle, whether it's the cougar ant or the China panda, these 1 ounce gold coins are 99% pure gold. They can be bought basically for a few dollars over the spot market. And you are simply treating them as a disaster hedge and a hedge against what we would call very, very powerful levels of inflation. Not 3, 4, 5%, but we're talking about powerful double-digit levels of inflation. And a number of people are doing that. Now, another way that you could possibly do this is to dollar cost average into a precious metal mutual fund, which have been beaten up, interestingly enough, even though the price of the precious metal itself has been reaching new highs. So would it be imprudent to have 5% of your portfolio in actual precious metal? Probably not. Probably not. Very frankly, I'm contemplating doing that myself and actually changing the allocation of our couch potato portfolio. If I do that, I would certainly announce that on the program of any change to the couch potato portfolio. I'm a little concerned that if you do go out and you buy precious metal, that you take what's called a safekeeping confirmation certificate and you let someone else hold the metal for you. I'm not in favor of that. If I'm going to go out and put on a hedge, I'm either going to do it through a mutual fund, a diversified mutual fund, or more likely actually own the gold and then have it stored at the bank in a lockbox as a percentage of my allocation. A safekeeping confirmation certificate is just not enough comfort for me where someone else is storing my precious metal and charging me a fee to do so. So I'd be very, very cautious about that. But gold as a strategy, as a percentage of a portfolio, you have to think of it as a disaster hedge because it doesn't pay interest, it doesn't pay dividends. It's a disaster hedge against hyperinflation. So another great question from one of our listeners.
All right, very good. And again, we'll get back here to the phones. We have just about 10 minutes left in this first hour of Focus 580. That's our monthly show on personal finance, and our guest is David Sino. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I. And question is welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Monticello, line number two. Hello.
Good morning,
yes.
Mr. Sinow.
Good morning.
I would like your opinion, sir, of a fixed income portfolio that is recommended by a man with a national radio audience for those who have no stock market holdings. Now, here's what he recommends and the weightings, and they're all in Vanguard, by the way. Vanguard Ginny Mae Fund, he recommends a 40% weighting. Short-term investment-grade bonds, 35%. Inflation-protected securities, TIPS, at 10%. And finally, Vanguard high-yield corporate bonds at a 15% weighting. I would like your thoughts about that. Again, for somebody who has no stock market holdings and doesn't perhaps have any in mind going forward for a while, and if you have any positive thoughts about that portfolio, for somebody sitting on some money market cash right now, would you buy some of that all at once, or would you dollar cost average into that too? And I'll hang up now and look forward to your answer.
Well, I would certainly dollar cost average into these positions, and I would be very, very concerned about placing substantial amounts of money in a high yield bond fund at the current time, even though those dividend rates and those interest rates that they're paying look awfully, awfully attractive. We don't have to look any further than a GM bond, which was trading at 70 cents on the dollar and now has dropped 30 cents on the dollar. So when we look at bond funds, we always have to look at total return. We can't look at current yield. So I would be very, very concerned about a 15% allocation to a high-yield bond fund at the current time, given today's corporate marketplace and the issues that corporations around the globe have. I've always liked Ginnie Mae's. Okay? They're clean, they're neat, they're insured. Just like treasuries, Ginnie Mae's are insured. But remember, in any bond fund, the net asset value, the share value of a bond fund can move up and down, and it can move up and down a lot depending upon the direction of interest rates. I like tips, even in this marketplace. I like tips. So I have no problem with the Ginnie Mae's. I have no problem with the tips. The short-term corporates, well, you have to probably make a long-term commitment to short-term corporates. That's the long and the short of it. No pun intended. Probably in terms of that allocation, I don't really have a problem with that. I think my big bone to pick here is with the high yields, but I would definitely dollar cost average in to a fixed income portfolio. And maybe at the same time, you might hedge your bets a little bit. And if you are at Vanguard, you can go to brokered CDs that are FDIC insured. And maybe in lieu of that high yield, at least buy brokered CDs. That would probably be my strategy if I just simply wanted to buy fixed income. But interestingly enough, you've got to be prepared for a lot of volatility in that fund. So whatever funds that you're in, make sure that you stay relatively short. Even the Ginnie Mae bond fund is a relatively short maturing bond fund. Don't go out and buy bonds that are maturing 15 or 20 years out in the yield curve. That's way, way, way too much volatility and just too much risk for the portfolio. But keep in mind that you've got to deal with volatility and you've got to look at total return as opposed to current income. So that would be my comments about that particular portfolio.
Okay. And again, next caller is Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hello. Yes. Sorry, I tuned in late. But anyway, I was going to ask you just two questions, quick, more specific. I just left a job where I had a 401k, roughly about $20,000 that I'm moving into a personal IRA account. And I can actually even trade in this account, my new IRA account, with this $20,000. And I was just thinking, given the current atmosphere, I was trying to brainstorm for how to maybe allocate this. I mean, you know, I'm only 40 years old. I've got a little bit of time to put into this. But for a small dollar amount like that, I was trying to avoid using mutual funds. I was trying to avoid fees in some of the funds. But as you said, I was considering maybe a Vanguard fund. But anyway, I guess the long story short is how would you possibly try to allocate that on such a small dollar amount for an IRA?
Well, I think it's
fund?
Very, very tough to buy individual stocks with $20,000, right? That's number one, because you subject yourself to something called unsystematic risk. You might buy three great companies, then you buy the fourth one that just blows up and it ruins your portfolio. So I probably would be buying funds. That would be number one. Number two, at 40 years of age, let's face it, if you're putting that money into an IRA, at least currently, the law says that you're really not supposed to access it till at least 59 and a half. So your time horizon is a minimum of 20 years. So I would not have a problem with your dollar cost averaging in over the next perhaps 12 to 24 months that money and averaging it into a series of high-class, low-expense mutual funds. That's what I would probably do. And I would probably have the majority of that money going into equities, into stock mutual funds as opposed to fixed income mutual funds. So if you're at a brokerage firm, you can do some research. You can look at indexes. You can look at some actively managed mutual funds, et cetera. But I would make certain that I had large, I had small, I had value, I had growth, I had U.S., and I had some international. And I think with that amount of money, you can actually allocate your dollars across all of those asset classes. And that's frankly what I would do because, again, you've got this long-term time horizon. You have 20 years before you can even think about accessing the money. And even at 59, your life expectancy is probably pretty close to 85 for a male. So we've got to add another 25 years. So we're really looking at a time horizon of about 40 to 45 years. And over that period of time, I feel pretty comfortable with your allocating your money into the stock market.
Oh, great. Thanks. The only other question I was going to ask, my mother's 68, and she had, maybe the same kind of, maybe $20,000, $25,000 in some of these mutual funds. I think a couple of them were stock mutual funds. And if she needs to withdraw those in a sooner time horizon, I guess I was just trying to brainstorm for whether she, you know, she could let it sit in there, given it's already lost maybe 20, 25% of its value over the last couple of years.
Sure.
Or try to pull it out now, cut losses, given that it could go lower.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of questions. Is this IRA money or is this after-tax money?
And this is actually after-tax money now.
Okay. And does she need the money for a living?
And I think she probably will within the next 4 or 5 years.
Okay. Well, probably if she needs the money over the next 4 or 5 years, I probably, to the extent that it's invested, I would probably leave it at the current time. It's very, very difficult to pull money out at these very depressed levels. And if she doesn't need the money for 4 or 5 years, my suggestion would be for her to ride with it, even though it is painful. She probably will be ahead 4 to 5 years out. Even though we don't have crystal balls, that would be my thinking about it.
Right.
But certainly if she needs the money in a short period of time, no one has any business having money in the stock market if you're going to need that money over a short period of time.
Gotcha. And very, very last question real quick. I was going to follow up on your gold on the another caller. As you mentioned, some of these gold funds are depressed, given even though the gold is sort of rising in value. For example, an exchange-traded fund in gold, I was trying to understand why that would be, that these would be depressed, the values of some of these gold funds, whereas gold itself is going up. How do you explain that?
Well, part of it has to do with the financial balance sheets of these companies, and some of these companies have diversified into other areas. So as a result, that has had a negative impact on a lot of these funds. I think you can buy an ETF, that would be okay, or actually buying the gold itself. But again, you've got a dollar cost average in. You can't go in at a $1,000 level and just buy gold and then find out that a month later it's at $700. Maybe it'll be at $1,300. We don't know. That's the value of dollar cost averaging in.
Right. Great. Well, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. This is just, you know, and all this talk about gold, the thing that I think about and people I would think would certainly have to keep in mind is the tremendous volatility.
No question.
And I'm looking here at the price of gold over the last year. And a year ago, it hit, I believe, what was an historic high. It was over $1,000 an ounce. And then a few months later, and this I think would have been last November, it hit a low of $709.50. So I'm thinking,
down
okay,
30%.
People rushed out there saying, well, they're looking for security, and they say, well, let's go to gold. And I'm wondering how those people who bought it at 1,000 felt when November it was at 709. Now it's climbed back. Now it's, I'm not sure, it's maybe around somewhere.
980.
Yeah, something like that. So it's regained its value. But it seems to me like you just have to, if you're going to do that, almost you'd have to not, you can't even look at what's going on.
Well, David, and that's why you have to have a disciplined dollar cost averaging approach because you've got to allocate the same amount of money at the end of each quarter or the end of each month to this kind of position because when it is volatile, you obviously want to be able to take advantage of the $700 price. Maybe you won't be so excited about the $1,000 price, but you have to average in. There's no question about it. You cannot go out and simply commit 5% of your portfolio today. Gee, I'm going to go out and buy gold. Yeah. You might wake up tomorrow with a big headache.
All right. We'll try real quick to get in, I think, at least one more caller. We'll go to Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello. And if you've already answered this question, please tell me because it's time short, I know. But for the life of me, Mr. Sinnoh, I cannot understand. Assume 2 years ago I went out and bought a house for $200,000, and the bank gave me $200,000, and I went and paid the $200,000 to buy the house, and the $200,000 was put into the economy. Now that house is only worth $100,000. The $100,000 disappeared someplace, but it has to have been around someplace. So what's going on here with these billions of dollars?
Well, let me understand your question. You went out and purchased.
No, I'm not saying I didn't.
No, I understand. But let's just presume that we went out and we purchased a $200,000 house.
Yes.
And we procured, obviously, a mortgage on that house. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
All right. And we probably had 20% down.
Sure.
And we procured a mortgage of $180,000.
That's right.
On that house. We then turned around and gave the seller $200,000.
Exactly.
All right? That seller presumably did something with the money, other
exactly.
than sticking it under the mattress, which probably would have been a better idea, but I don't suggest people put money under a mattress.
Exactly.
Okay? That seller took that money and probably bought financial securities, maybe paid off some debt.
Yep.
And as it turns out, those financial securities, as we know, even the S&P 500 has dropped over from its highs in October of 2007. The S&P 500 has actually dropped 50%. So as a result, if this person had bought securities, even in the stock market, they may well be down 50% in the stock market. So in terms of taking money, we watched real cash disappear in terms of profitability for this individual. Now, at the same time, you or I have this $200,000 house with a $180,000 mortgage, which is now worth less than the mortgage itself. 30% of Americans now find themselves with a mortgage greater than their real estate. So another problem here. So what is going to happen? Well, a lot of people are going to say, gee, I think I'll just walk away. I'll foreclose.
No, the question I'm asking, sir, is this. We had money that was interjected into the system,
mm-hmm.
but now it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Where'd it go? It had to go someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had to get the money. It went to the bank or went to somebody. What happened to it?
We just might have to leave that question hang in the air because we're at the time that we're going to have to finish. Sometimes I think maybe the
my lead-off question next month.
All right.
And take us through a scenario and see where those dollars are, because what we're really talking about is a money supply issue, and it's something that I need to study so I can give a more intelligent answer.
Okay. We'll have to finish up there. Our guest, David Sinnoh, clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, is with us once a month. On a Friday, we talk about personal finance. Thanks very much.